Just, this is kind of the corporate side on health equity, but, you know, we've been, I think probably 12 years, we've been 12 or 13 years doing stuff with the Alliance, and we keep a pretty close eye on the market, just trying to see where trends are. We've been growing at about 30-40% a year, and so we always need to try and stay a little bit ahead of the curve. And I'll be honest with you, though, when I was asked to kind of kick this off, I felt a little nervous because even though of our 34,000 employers, I think a couple thousand of them probably are ASO. I can tell you people like Neil and Brian and Rick and Keith probably know a lot more about ASO business than we do. So I actually had to do some research. Now, I'll tell you that I'm much more nervous to give a talk next Friday because I have to give the graduation address at my daughter's sixth grade school. And I'm absolutely nervous wreck over it. I don't know what to say. And my daughter keeps saying, "Dad, just please don't embarrass me." And so if I can get through this one, then I'm off to read the lessons I should have learned in kindergarten, which is my content for that. So as I mentioned, health equity has been around now for about 15 years, and we really are focused on the HSA space with the other health accounts, but hopefully we can kind of show you how ASO, we're seeing the ASO market evolve over time and then tie it back into some of the stuff that we do every day. So many of you have seen this graph, but I would argue that if it weren't for these diverging lines, basically workers' earnings and the cost of premiums, and then overall inflation and, well, workers' earnings on the bottom, we wouldn't be talking about health reform. There might not even be a big push for ASO, but it's this challenge that we have. Health insurance premiums and then what we're asking people to contribute to those premiums compared to overall inflation and how much we're paying them. And so we need to try and, whatever way we can attack those lines, whether it's ASOs or whether it's higher deductibles or CDHPs or more consumer engagement, we're certainly committed to as a company. We like to say that our mission at Health Equity is to help people better save and spend their healthcare dollars, and in doing so, help save healthcare. And then we've kind of added a little rejoinder at the end and help them build long-term retirement savings. This is even more graphic. Back in 1999, I was in medical school then. That's when I first started researching health equity. The average consumer for an individual was paying about $2,100 in their annual premiums. Families were paying $5,700. Kaiser said that in 2016, the number had gone from those numbers to $6,400 for a single and $18,000 for a family. Now, I presented this similar slide yesterday. We had a number of our large employers in Salt Lake City for what we call our Key Partner Summit, and these are, in fact, Intermountain was there and a few other folks, PwC, and the people from New York were like, "That's cheap. You know, $18,000, what is this? That's cheap." But one of the things that I think makes all employers concerned about these numbers is that it actually is getting pretty close to this kind of Cadillac tax, whether it comes in or not. It's getting close. And so, and is currently constituted unless the law changes. I think the House bill pushed the Cadillac tax back to 2026, is that right? But it's currently in law. And I don't know what's going to happen out of D.C. It seems like there's a few other distractions going on. That Cadillac tax is going to kick in 2020. And for every dollar over the Cadillac tax thresholds, remember, these are average numbers, it's a 40% excise tax for every dollar spent. So I think that's one of the reasons why a lot of these companies are headed towards ASO, too. You know, this graph I look at every year when Kaiser puts it out. And if you think about, you know, back in 99, if you take all firms, that's this number, 66% of them offered benefits. And if you got up to the square box, 50 to 99 workers, 96% of them, it's this one up here. Maybe I got a pointer here. But they offered benefits. But you can kind of see there's just been a bit of a gradual decline. Now, clearly, the largest firms in the country still in the high 90s offer benefits. But when you get down into this number right here, kind of right in this is the one I think you need to track, the all firms one. You can see it's dropped. 10% of all firms are offering health. If you take all firms, 10% of them, there's been a 10% decrease in offering benefits. And the smaller firms, you can see it's gone down pretty significantly. And so on one hand, you may say, well, we're losing commercial business fully insured to self-funded. But if it's a way to keep them insured, I think that's maybe that's the end game. You know, keep people insured. As you think about how you're going to design self-funded plans, I think you need to think about that the larger employers get, the more plan types they're going to offer. Small employers, 50 and smaller, tend to offer one plan. You know this. As you start to get bigger, larger employers are going to offer a lot more plans, and just kind of a general principle. Now, this is data that I pirated from Employee Benefit Research Institute. And in my research, I basically looked at three or four different sources. I looked at the Kaiser study. Do any of you read that? It comes out in September of every year. I think my experience has been the Kaiser study that's in September every year is the most consistent. I think they've been doing it now for 17, 18 years. Some great data in there, not just for self-funding, but for all commercial types. I looked at a bunch of EBRI stuff, Employee Benefit Research Institute. And then I spent quite a bit of time on the SIA website. Does anyone know about SIA? Self-Insured Institute of America. And SIA has different annual meetings and things like that. And I think that might make sense for some of the members to attend. I don't know what the benefits of going or not, but SIA has some pretty good data too. So SIA.org, I think, was very helpful. Folks from EBRI are just saying that over time, you've seen a pretty significant increase. Back in 96, about 28% of private sector establishments had at least one self-insured plan. That's up to now almost 40%. And then if you look at back to the Kaiser data, the percentage of workers in self-funded plans by employer size, you can see that if you go down to 3 to 99, that number's been pretty stable, around 13%. But if you take 200 or more, it's up to 82% of firms now are in self-funded plans. And so, that's, I think, the market that a lot of you are targeting. And, I think I'm sure that in a later session you're going to talk about network issues. Select Health's been our carrier for a long time. And our company, we started out when we first moved to Utah from Arizona. I think we had about 30 team members. Now we have almost 1,000. And for the first year, we decided to go self-funded in the last year. So we're one of your folks that crossed over. And we also had to bring in another network besides Select Health because of the fact that we have now about 100 people outside of the state of Utah. And so I think that's, I'm sure, a complexity that some of your speakers will talk about, because bigger firms tend to be multi-state, your networks start to suffer a little bit, and so I'll let smarter people than me talk about that. This is the percentage of workers in self-funded plans by employer size. Same data, but you can just generally see that in this 3 to 99, it's kind of the same data we just talked about. The two takeaways I took from this table was 13% of workers with less than 200 employees are in self-funded plans, but 50% of workers in this spot. This is 200 to 1,000 employees, basically. 50% of those workers are in self-funded. And so you almost have to say that, look, once an employer starts getting a couple hundred employees, Keith, has this been your experience in Ohio and now done, that once you get over a couple hundred employees, those people are at risk to drop into self-funded. So if you don't have a good self-funded offering and everything that goes into that, then you may lose them. So that makes sense. So straight off the SIA.org, they've got some pretty good propaganda. If I'm a consultant and I'm kind of thinking about why I should do this, or if I'm an employer, they're going to push it pretty hard. I know the actuary in the audience said, not so fast, but they're saying control, just what Rick said. Improve cash flow, right? You don't have to, you may not have to pay those claims for a while. Right, but then they spend a lot of time talking about on their website the benefit around taxes and being able to eliminate most premium taxes. State taxes, they think, are typically 1.5 to 3%. Is this consistent with with your experience that the brokers and the consultants are saying, hey, first thing is you're going to save some taxes right off the bat, And you're also going to kind of eliminate the carrier profit margins and risk charges of another 3 to 5%. So they're saying on their website, right out of the bat, you're going to save 6, 7%, even if you can benefit, if you don't benefit from the cash flow and things like that. And then the improved claims data history they push. We had this experience, honestly, when we were smaller, that we just couldn't get access to our claim data. Kind of drove us crazy. It was almost like, yeah, if you go self-funded, you can do it. But maybe that's a strategy to keep people fully insured, is do a better job of getting them their claim data. Maybe that's one of the reasons why. But Brian, is that something you ever hear? I mean,
no question. Yeah, the clients want to know about their information on claims on an ongoing basis.
Reporting is really important if you want to stop them from going self-funded.
Yeah, so maybe as a, I know a couple of the people in their intro said, we're trying to keep people from going self-funded. Maybe that's a strategy to at least delay it, is getting better reporting, because that was a big frustration for us. Steve, for many years at Health Equity, ran our people department, and Steve, I know we asked a lot, can't we just get better and look into our claims? So they talk about the negatives on their website too. You know, you got this 10 to 25% risk of expected claims. They say, you know, you could blow through it if you have a terrible year, and that's if you have stop loss. Obviously, there's no ceiling without stop loss. I think most smaller firms are going to have stop loss. And then there are some cash flow fluctuations, and so you may be good one, like going to Las Vegas, right? But then the other thing they stress is if you're going to go self-funded, you really do need to look at it from a long-term perspective. So I guess my takeaway there would be, if a firm decides to go self-funded, and they're probably going to be doing it for at least 4 or 5 years until they sort things out. Again, off the SIA.org site, they kind of have a nice little infographic here that basically says this is the annual cost comparison, and they're laying this out for consultants and employers and kind of side-by-side comparison of kind of where it's going to lay out if you're in a self-funded versus a fully insured premium. This is in your notes. So what we're seeing generally in the market, and I'm going to try and bring these two concepts together. When Obamacare was passed, when the ACA was rolled out, I think we were pretty nervous because we didn't know exactly what was going to be in that sausage, right? And, you know, we're a company, and I worked, in full disclosure, worked for Intermountain for a number of years as a trauma surgeon. When I was in my surgical residency, it's when I, almost as an academic exercise, that's when I started Health Equity. But by the time 2010 rolled around, I was kind of all in, right? I was practicing surgery about a half a day a week, and this was my livelihood. And so you can imagine when it was at March of 2010, when the final bill that no one had read, but they voted on, right, was passed out, we were pretty nervous there might be some gotchas in there for our business, which was consumer-directed healthcare. The big things that came out of HSAs were, number one, it kind of validated the health savings account qualified plan. They said, if you're looking for what may otherwise be deemed as kind of the lowest level of credible coverage in the ACA, as long as it's HSA qualified under the HSA laws that were passed back in 2004, then we're going to say it's okay. So that was actually, you know, a plus for us, and that's why we've seen our market take off. You know, there were a few other things that in the House bill they've tried to reverse. Like, they took the penalty for taking money out of your HSA from 10%, which is the way it was originally written, plus your tax rate, and this is for non-healthcare related expenses, to 20%. The House bills rolled that back to 10%. There was an over-the-counter thing that Obamacare said, that you can't use your HSA dollars for over-the-counter meds. And other than that, I mean, there were a few things on the exchanges that were kind of funky. But at the end of the day, we're actually pretty happy. And we've seen our market, I mean, I think back in 2010, we were probably at about 500,000 accounts and about $1 billion of assets under management. We're now at 3 million accounts almost, and $5 billion of health savings. And so we've seen an explosion because of Obamacare. But one thing that's happened, I mean, if you look at this 2010, right, again, all small firms, 46% of them in 2010 had a deductible of about $1,000 or more. Now it's 65%. I mean, who would have thought that the former president of the United States would stand up and say, hey, everyone has insurance, and you've got really good insurance, and your deductible is only $4,000, right? It was kind of the way that it came out of Obamacare that you saw this surge in high deductibles. And so we've been trying to pound this drum all along saying, yeah, plans are going to high deductibles, but the antidote for the high deductible is to set up some sort of spending account, health savings account we think is the best to help people offset that. We are seeing a lot more employers now offer HSAs and HRAs. I don't know what the little blurb was in 31%, may have been a reporting issue, but you've kind of seen this steady march from 2005 up to 28% of firms. And this data that came out of a couple of years ago from Towers projected that by 2015, they never did a follow-up study on this, that about 30% of firms were going to make HSAs their only choice. And so you kind of have the self-funded thing that seems to have accelerated with Obamacare. You have these high deductibles that seems to have accelerated under Obamacare and HSAs, and now we think they're kind of meeting in the middle here. As far as workers and what they're choosing, last year there was actually a statistically significant jump for the first time in many years where the percentage of people in HSA-qualified plans went from 15% to 19%. Now, the HRA plans, some of you do HRA plans, those have been kind of flat, kind of stayed stable, but HSAs seem to be kind of accelerating as well. And as a lot of you know, that Trump Care, there are some provisions in the Trump Care that would, some people think would accelerate HSAs even further. And then the Senate, I was in D.C. last week, they're saying that if they're going to get senators in, then they want to even put more friendly HSA provisions. And so we expect it's going to continue to take off, which is good for us. This is a similar graph that just says that you can kind of see that over the last 10 years, or last 20 years now, the conventional plans have gone from 73% virtually down to zero. HMOs have been squeezed a little bit too, going from 16% just down to 15%. But the PPOs are changing, and the high deductible plans are going up quite a bit. Total accounts that are out there right now, this is our business, there's about 20 million HSAs by the end of 2016. And then assets have grown quite a bit. I think this graph is pretty important as you think about what employers are thinking through on this. If an employer has a non-account-based plan, this is according to the National Business Group on Health, Towers Watson, then their costs are going to be $12,000. If they go to full replacement, their costs are going to drop by basically 20%. So that's the mentality that's driving it this way. And then if you couple that with an ASO offering, you can kind of see where employers are heading on cost. This is just another way to look at it from the savings by going from HSAs to HRAs and the like. And we're showing data that says that HRAs are kind of tailing off. And one of the things that employers ask us all the time is, how do people make a transition from going from an HRA plan to an HSA plan? And so we spend a lot of time talking through that. If any of you want to, again, there's a few bullets in there that might make sense to you. We'd be happy to answer questions on that. And so getting back to kind of what employers are doing by size, right? If you say all firms, just take all firms, 15, this is the data that just came out in September. 15% of them are HMOs. 48%, right, are PPOs. 9% of point of service plans. And then you can see that kind of bump of the 29% of the employees are in an HDHP with a savings option. So it's kind of heading in that direction. Percentage of workers in self-funded plans by plan type. 69% of workers in PPOs are in self-funded plans, and 67% of workers in HSAs and HRAs are in self-funded plans. Now, what I think is the most interesting about this graph is that you can see that in 99, there was no employers in high-deductible plans that were self-funded. But all of a sudden, you see this number going from 50% in 2006 is up to 67%. So as you think about how do I offer, and maybe this is the most important takeaway, you know, as you think, you know, what? So how do you put this all together? if you're saying, I want to go into the ASO business because I want to be competitive, I need to start putting together an offering that's going to be competitive. I need to have my actuaries on board, because when a 200 life employer or a 300 life employer or a 500 life employer decides to go self-funded, they're going to rely upon their carrier and their consultant to help them with the offering. And the offering includes, how do I price these plan designs? Right? I think most 500 life employers, if they sit down with their carrier of choice that they've been with and they say, look, it's time for us to go self-funded, if you can say, here's the offering we would suggest you put together for your people, including how do you price the premiums, right? Because we didn't know. I mean, Health Equity, we had no idea how to price it. We knew how much we were paying Select Health, but now we were kind of paying ourselves now when we went self-funded. So we needed the help from the carrier or a good consultant to say, here's how much you should put in reserves. Here's how much you should charge. This should be the breakdown. And what I'm suggesting is that now a lot of firms are saying, and I want to offer a high deductible plan in conjunction to my ASO plan. Help me structure that. And then your actuaries have to be thoughtful enough to say, this is how you do you architect the solution for self-funded HSA plans, self-funded HMO plans, self-funded POS plans. So it's really changing pretty aggressively to go from virtually zero in 99 to 60%. Our 67% of workers in that plan type is, I think, one of the biggest takeaways. The other thing you need to think about as you go into these different plan offerings is, what other things do larger employers like? Well, we've established larger employers like to go self-funded. Larger employers increasingly like to offer higher deductibles with some sort of savings option, right? The other thing that they do is they want to offer health risk assessments. Smaller employers may not think about it. Larger employers want that. And so you can kind of see percentage of firms that offer, once you get over that kind of 200, it's this blue bar, once you get over 200 employees, 60% of them want to do a health risk assessment. So if you can bake that in, I'm sure there's some partners here that you work with that are offering health risk assessments in conjunction with that. The other thing they want to do is do biometric screening. Much higher percentage of larger employers that happen to be self-funded also want biometric screening. So these are things you want to incorporate. Now, I have a few extra slides. I don't know if it's, let's see, is Carrie here? See if you have that other deck. We commissioned a study, just as we can bring this on. Let's see if
Steve,
you have it.
While he's bringing that up, one thing that wasn't addressed in here is what's the employers are putting in, sometimes they are, sometimes they aren't, but they're putting money into the HSA. What's the typical amount? And then how are the employees actually funding their accounts or not funding their accounts? So the fact that you have an HSA doesn't necessarily mean that you're putting money into it. And you've got so many people that are saying they're living paycheck to paycheck and they have these much higher out-of-pockets. So what's the employee contribution?
You know, obviously there's a big variation. If you look at the larger firms, the self-funded firms that we manage, again, we have a couple thousand. On average, they're funding about 50% of the deductible. That's what the employer is doing. So if the deductible's $3,000, they're putting in usually between $1,000 and $1,500 into the account. So they'll put in $100 a month, right? And then the employee has to fund the rest. We've actually had pretty remarkable funding experience, and a lot of it's because we've worked with many of you to do an integrated relationship where when the time they enroll in their benefits, they're also enrolling in their health savings account. Because even if an employer wants to fund the account, if people never open the account, you can't fund it. And so we have kind of a one experience. Did you find that? Okay, great. I'll explain this to you in a few minutes. But we commissioned a study that may be helpful where we went out and surveyed almost 300 employers. And so I'm going to show you a few of these things here in a second. But the short answer is, Kathy, is that the larger employers are funding upwards of 50% of the deductible, smaller employers less than that. There are some employers that don't fund anything. I think a tragic mistake, okay, when you're dealing with employers, and I don't know why they do this, is to, local university in Utah does this, and it just drives me crazy. In fact, I was on the phone with their HR person last week talking about this, is they say, and this comes back to plan design, and left to their own devices, they'll do stupid stuff, right? I mean, most people, they'll say, our actuaries have decided that you're going to save a couple $100 a month by going to the higher deductible. You're going from basically a $300 deductible to a $3,000 deductible, it's worth a couple $100 a month in premium savings, 20% or whatever. We're just going to make that the free plan or the cheapest plan. So as an employee, I can either choose the higher plan, the PPO plan, and let's say it's going to cost me $100 a pay period, $200 a month, $2,400 a year, or I'm going to choose the HSA plan, and it's free. Now, can anyone think about why that would be a stupid idea? I can give you like five reasons. Now, a lot of you work with hospital systems. Doctors, my former colleagues, don't want to drive Yugos. And that tells them, oh, it's the free plan, it must be junk. Even if you're offering them a $3,000 deductible and $2,400 a year of premium savings, plus the ability to defer another $5,000 roughly $4,500, depends on their age, of pre-tax earnings, right? So smart plans have said, we're not going to do that. There's another problem. So there's a perception issue. So you'll end up with the wrong people signing up for it, right? So we've had hospital systems, for example, that have done this, and instead of getting the high earners that sign up for it and the ones that could actually get hit by a $3,000 deductible, you end up with the janitors that sign up with it. And then guess what? Their kid's appendix goes out in February, and now they owe their own employer $3,000, and now their employer is sending their employee to collections. It's a disaster. Okay, so you've got a perception issue. You got the wrong people signing up for it. Here's another issue. Is every dollar that someone puts in their HSA and they take it out of their payroll to do so, it saves their employer, on average, about 8%. Maybe on average, if you take out the high wage earners that hit their FICA tax, it's maybe 7%. But it's basically about 7 cents of every dollar if it goes into an HSA. So if I say to a bunch of people, hey, guess what, you get the free plan, and those people don't fund the account, the employer is getting hit with a payroll tax problem. So the smart employers would say, you know what, in that example, they may say, all right, the HSA plan is going to only cost you $50 a pay period, $100 a month. But then they take that $100 a month and they put it right into the HSA. They pass it right through. So now you're taking the money out of the payroll, the employer's saving the payroll taxes, and they're putting the money in the HSA. Perception-wise, now you have the doctor looking at it going, or the higher income person going, well, this plan looks pretty good because I'm getting $1,200 a year in the HSA, plus I'm saving $1,200 on premium, so I'm going to do that. So there's a perception issue. The other thing that they do oftentimes, it's a mistake, is they'll call it the high deductible plan. That's like calling it the Yugo, right? So we work with Google, and they taught us this powerful lesson in marketing. They said, we're not going to call it the high deductible plan. They said, we're going to call it the GHIP plan, the Google Health Investment Plan. And now they've got about 30 or 40, maybe I think we're up to 40, 50% of their Googlers that have signed up for it. So you got to fund it. You got to make this look better, and you need to kind of position it the right way. So that's enough on marketing. So does that answer your question? Yeah, I'm sorry, questions, yes. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I just got a question, kind of following up on Kathy, too, regarding utilization. You know, as these deductibles have increased, have you tracked or looked at trends in utilization? I think, because what I'm starting to hear a little bit is that, you know, employees aren't, or members aren't going to utilize the services. You're going to hold off on utilizing services, which may exacerbate costs down the road. And then once they do exceed that deductible, then they overutilize. And so just curious on your thoughts on that, what you've seen or where you see that going from that standpoint.
I mean, I think that there was a bigger issue around that prior to Obamacare, because now Obamacare requires all plans to have preventive services. And so the data I've looked at shows that there are some very specific utilization changes. Number one, there's a lot more folks that go to 90-day pharmacy or to generic from name brand, right? So there is a drop there. The first time ER visit rate is about the same between plan types. But the second time, and these are when they're classified as non-emergent conditions and end up in the ER, the second time visit drops by about 50% in the high deductible plan. There's been some people that have suggested that, you know, there is an education gap, but people need to know that these are covered services. Because remember, under the ACA, every plan, doesn't matter if you're high deductible or not, has to offer free preventative care. One of the things that we're pushing on the, what I would call the pro-HSA, but what's called now the value-based initiative, has anyone heard that terminology, is to allow for preventative care that's paid first dollar to be expanded. Right now, the federal regulators who wrote the code gave two examples of drugs that you could provide first dollar that doesn't have to come out of the HSA. Does anyone know there in the regs? So they said, so what it says is that you can give free drugs under the HSA benefit, doesn't have to come out of the HSA, but it has to prevent disease from occurring. And they said, for example, you could use statins or blood pressure drugs. I mean, I'm a physician and those are great, but doggone it, people should be getting their diabetic meds and their asthma meds and osteoporosis and probably birth control. There's probably six different categories of disease. Some people say like COAGs for blood people on blood thinners. But those would be the ones that really pay for it. Brian, do you have a comment on that?
Yeah, I was just going to mention about another major reason why employers go self-funded is to avoid mandated benefits.
Yep.
So with ERISA, you're federally regulated by the Department of Labor. So that's the difference. ERISA was passed in 74 because of the Studebaker Auto Company in Indiana, where I am, going bankrupt, and for pension regulation, but they included welfare plans in it. So that basically says that your regulation is much different. I find that's real difficult for health plans, so they're so used to the state regulators.
Yep.
There are exceptions to ERISA, though. It's the any government entity or religious organizations are exceptions to ERISA. So that means they are still subject to state mandated benefits. And many of you have government, a lot of counties, cities, you know, state employees, all those are still, or religious organizations can be, you know, churches, organizations, or hospitals related with religious organizations. They're still subject to the state mandated benefits, but it depends on your state. You know, do you have lots of mandated benefits that some employers may not want to pay for? I mean, it's obviously a big issue, but that can be a major reason why an employer will go self-funded.
Yeah, that's a good point. Just to finish the thought, though, are in really looking at the data, and this is large employers that have parsed this data. Employee Benefit Research Institute does publish a lot of stuff on user behavior, and they suggest that there is a decrease in what they would call non-essential services. There's a few, you know, blurbs there, but there has been very little data to suggest that people are avoiding the important stuff, especially now because preventive care is free. Now, you have to educate people. And so we do have, I mentioned Google earlier, they have another program as part of their GHIP plan that if you go and get your doctor visit, you get $200 in your HSA. And if your spouse goes and gets your annual physical, they'll give your spouse $200 too. So, yeah, go ahead.
Steve, we've got about 10 minutes.
Okay.
So just to kind of put some context with the rising deductibles after Obamacare, the real reason that occurred was ACA required all services to count towards the max out-of-pocket, which was not common before, and it also put a cap on the max out-of-pocket. So to keep similar price points, deductibles had to rise. So that's, you know, why that, you know, happened so precipitously at that point. The second part of your question about people hitting their max out of pocket and throwing a bunch of service in, I think that happens HSA plan or non-HSA plan. I think people in general, at least sicker people, are understanding how that works and have more benefit literacy around the max out-of-pocket than they used to. And I'll speak from personal experience that we absolutely do that. We'll try to plan something big for the beginning of the year, and then, you know, once we hit our max out-of-pocket right at the end of the year, we're filling every script as many times as we can get it filled. And
yeah. Katie brought
the door. But I think that happens. I think that's just that's going to happen one way or the other. The HSA just makes it a lot easier for the member to budget. And in that sense, as a consumer, I'm a big fan of HSAs.
So it sounds like, oh, yes, go ahead.
In order for to maximize the value of consumer-driven or high deductible, how do you empower the consumer to have, I'm looking at price transparency.
Sure.
In order for the consumer to be able to know this provider versus that, I think that's still a real barrier.
No, it's a big, look, and it's a challenge. And we work with not only a bunch of the plans here, but also about 100 hospital systems. And it's really hard when they don't want to show their own transparency. So I'll let you take that up in the June session when you're having a discussion with your owners or the hospital systems, because it is a little bit embarrassing because no one wants to be seen in their underwear, right? And it's like, I don't know how to deal with that. Now, I can tell you one of the things we've done with certain plans, and some actually in this room, is that we're starting to say, because we have about 25% of our people come to our website every month because they're just paying bills off of it and checking their account balance and investing and stuff like that. It's more of a banking site. So we're now starting to expose telemedicine options, price transparency options right there to the member. And we did do a really cool experiment with a large hospital system where over a three-month period, we were able to, I think, 15,000 unique people logged onto the website to check account balance, and we ended up messaging them about a price transparency solution they had paid for but not enrolled in, and 2,000 of them went over and enrolled in the price transparency solution. So if you can figure out the right, I know Vitals is here, but if you can figure out the right price transparency solution that actually works, we can help get people over there. Now I'll let Vitals divine out among this group how you're going to tell your owners or your business partners why they want to show that their MRI is $2,000 more expensive than the people across the street. That's another complicated issue. Again, above my pay grade, but it's real. And by the way, we're all in on it because I'd much rather have people keep an extra grand in their HSA because that's one of the ways we make money, is helping them manage that money. So we're all in on that. Great point. So just real quick, just a couple minutes. So we did a study, and think about this as, you know, who's going to make the decision on things, right? So we interviewed 276 employers. We hired this firm, ITE, and I didn't have the permission to publish this, but I can show you a couple slides. So we just kind of asked them the question, you know, are you doing, and this is a lot about HSAs, but I want to get to some of these slides. And so, you know, the respondents' role in benefits decision-making, okay? So basically, if the smaller the employer over here, between 10 and 99, you see one person, you know, the HR person basically makes the decisions, right? That's the takeaway there. Respondents' position title, it was usually the employee, benefits manager, director, or vice president 57% of the time, right? And that was their job, and those are the people we were talking to in the survey. So when the survey went out and we had this firm, we were talking to HR managers, people that run their benefits, right? And we just asked, you know, are you currently doing HSAs and FSAs? But let me go past that for a second. So they want a best-in-class solution. I think that's one thing that, as I've been around the country in most of your markets, I think you can really speak to best-in-class, which is great. And then, you know, what's the sales channel, right? This is, I think, one of the big takeaways, is they really are relying upon their benefit consultant quite a bit, right? And then their next choice is their insurance carrier. So you're in the market. They're going to trust you with different things. Now, in the survey was around HSAs, but it would be the same thing for ASOs, right? They're going to first go to their broker. So I don't know how to do that. I mean, what I've done in the past with many of you in the world of CDHPs, to Dennis's point, when we were running around the country and people didn't even know what CDHP stood for, guess what we would do? We would go out with you, and I'd go down to New Mexico with Neil, and we would do a broker thing on CDHPs. And it would be really well. I think you need to do the same thing for ASOs, right? You know, and I don't know if Brian was running around the country and talk about ASOs or whatever, but I think those broker training is really super important. Usually you can couch these as a CE, and, you know, for the first 52 minutes talk about the CE stuff so that the state person in the back of the room checks the box, and then you, for the next eight minutes, talk about your new ASO offering. But again, 67, so small businesses really rely upon their broker and less on their health plan. So I think that's something to think about. Right here, the role of the broker in the HSA vendor selections, and I'm asking you to kind of do a mental jump and say, role of the broker in the ASO, okay? Because I think it's very similar. Only 13% of respondents indicate that their broker is not at all influential. As much as it's painful, I'm sorry to tell you this, you know, and look, and part of the reason why we did this study is because we're partnered with so many health plans that we thought, well, if the health plan walks in and says, oh, here's your high deductible plan and here's our partner, that the employer would just go, okay, great, we love health equity, we're in. But you know what? We were a little bit dismayed to know, you know what, we really do need to spend a bunch of time with the broker educating them as well. They have, and maybe you're saying, yeah, you got a firm grasp on the obvious, but this was our way to validate this study. The other thing that I think is really important is customer service and administrative ease. One of the reasons why we've invested so much time in this integrated relationship we have with so many of you is because we need to make it easy and provide great service. I will digress for just 30 seconds, Dennis. My brother and I started a little airline in Utah back in, man, it was 1999. Oh, I'm sorry. I wish it was 1989. Sorry. Dated myself. But and then we sold it to Southwest Airlines in 1993, and then he went off to start JetBlue. And he was the one that really taught me about customer service. And, you know, he had his ups and downs at JetBlue. Any of you live in New York? Anyone involved in an ice storm in 2007? So my brother ended up losing his job because of these wicked ice storms. And one of the reasons why he lost his job was because on Valentine's Day of 2007, there was this terrible ice storm that hit the New York area. And there were people stranded on JetBlue and Delta flights, but JetBlue are the ones that took the hit on this, for like 8 hours, 10 hours, stuck on the runway because the planes were stuck in the ice. He went on, and I saw him on David Letterman, I saw him on Matt Lauer's show, talking about how, hey, look, this thing we used to hide behind in the airline industry around acts of God, we're not going to hide behind anymore. And if this ever happens again, we're going to refund everyone's tickets and pay them and all this stuff. Well, doggone it. Like a month later on St. Patrick's Day, the same thing happened. And it cost the airline like a couple $1 million because they were refunding all this money. And my brother's like, why are all these dead Catholics torturing me? He goes, what did I do here? Anyway, he lost his job. So he went off to be, he said, look, I got to go to a place where there's no more ice storms. So he went to Brazil and started another airline. And lo and behold, you know, to his credit, after many years of work, he just took that airline public, and it's called Azul. And on their first annual report, it has the top airlines in the world by TripAdvisor. And number one is Emirates Airline. Number two is Singapore Airline. Number three is Azul. And number four is JetBlue. So I was happy for my brother. But don't forget about your customer service. I guess I'll finish on that note. You have some great plans. You have some great local identity. I know that this is new territory for a lot of you, this ASO and the high deductible plans, but it sounds like you've got some great partners and some great people to draw upon. So hopefully that was helpful.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Any comments, reactions, other questions for Steve? Excellent, Steve. It's setting some context for us and giving us a market overview. Yeah, Ashley.
Hold on, Ashley.
Do you see regional variation between HRRAs and HSAs in terms of employer preference?
Yeah, Northeast is still very kind of entrenched in HRAs. Okay. In fact, that 9% number that's kind of hanging on, most of those are in New England. Upper Midwest, much more HSA oriented, and then West Coast is becoming much more HSA. I think, like in Utah, we hardly have any HRAs. A lot of it's a lineage. HRAs came out before HSAs by a year or two, and then there were some perceptions that they were more flexible. Yeah. Problem with the HRA is that only the employer can fund it, and so that creates problems. And you can't invest it. You can't really take it with you. There's not that additional benefit of getting tax relief, but it's changing, and that's why we think they're... Now, we manage, by the way, 2.7 million HSAs and about 500,000 HRAs, and our HRA business is actually growing as businesses have left, so it's growing pretty aggressively, but there is regional variation. Great question.
One other question or comment? Feedback? Well, Steve, you raised several issues that we're going to explore through the rest of the day, so great job.
Okay.
Dealing with pricing, dealing with product design, dealing with operations and customer service.
Networks.
And all of those building blocks. So yep. Thank you for kicking off the conversation.
Thank you.